This is HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. As the baby boomers become senior citizens and our aging population continues to live longer, the need for primary care physicians is growing in this country. But recent data suggests that their ranks are shrinking. So what role can medical schools play in this equation? Here with more on all of this is Dr. Christopher Morley, Associate Professor of Family Medicine, Public Health, and Psychiatry at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Morley. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
So we're facing a shortage of primary care. Tell us about that.
Sure. There are estimates that indicate that roughly between 40 and 50% of the physician workforce ought to be composed of primary care physicians to achieve optimal health outcomes. And that simply isn't the case. And it depends how you measure what a primary care physician is. So I'd be hesitant to quote a rate of what it is today because, you know, whether you count various specialties or different types of people doing different tasks, that rate can vary. But it certainly isn't 40 to 50% of the population.
And actually, I saw some stats that were suggesting that basically we're going to need about 100,000 primary care or family physicians that will be needed in the next 10 years. And right now, we're only about half the number is being attracted to meet that demand.
That's right. And the Robert Graham Center, located in Washington, D.C., which is a policy institute run by the American Academy of Family Physicians, has done a lot of work in that regard and generates a lot of these numbers. Listeners can certainly go to their website, the Robert Graham Center. It's pretty easy to find on Google. But there's a lot of information there about that. But that's true. We are not producing enough primary care physicians to replace those who retire, and there are all sorts of reasons for that.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, why do we think this is happening? I mean, some critics have posed the fact that doctors are working harder for lower pay. I'm talking about primary care now, mm-hmm. less prestige attached to it, more administrative headaches have turned doctors away from things like family medicine or internal medicine. But basically, what, in your experience, what else seems to be playing a role here?
Well, to be fair to the entire medical community, all physicians tend to be working harder and longer. That is not peculiar to primary care, and that's been since probably since the 80s, I would say. However, particularly in primary care, there are a lot of shifts that are going on. The electronic health record transition has certainly hit in recent years, and the transition to electronic health records certainly has good effects on the population level and on the system-wide level. But on the level of the individual primary care doc, there's a lot of expense in implementing a new system. There's a lot of lost productivity as they learn the new system and change their workflow to accommodate new systems. So primary care has been bearing a lot of that brunt.
And they're also become data clerks. I mean, they're maintaining so much more information in these new record-keeping systems that their time is spent doing a lot of that.
I think it's fair to say that while hospitals and hospital-based systems maintain data on sick people, knowing anything about the general population, the well and the worried well, those data come from primary care physicians' office. They're on the front lines of data collection. So from either a research perspective or the perspective of public policy, they're bearing the brunt.
So the consequences of people, of the shrinking pool, and the fact that the need is growing, obviously, seems self-evident. We're not going to have enough primary care doctors to take care of the growing need.
That's right. There's an old statistic that won't depict well as we talk about it on the radio without the visual, but basically most care occurs in the outpatient setting. Very few people actually are cared for in the hospital. It's out of 1,000 visits, there's a minuscule amount that actually occur in a hospital. But subspecialist-driven inpatient care gets most of our attention and most of our money. And that's part of the issue, and that's part of the reason why the health workforce and the physician workforce specifically is so skewed.
And also it seems to me that primary care has been the gatekeeper, both in the world of pediatricians as well as internal medicine or family practice. They've basically been the gatekeeper of keeping people healthy, prophylaxis, and keeping them out of emergency rooms and attempting to control the healthcare costs, and basically with a decrease in these gatekeepers, the question really remains: what's going to happen to the system? Sure. Will it bear?
I would actually want to dodge the term gatekeeper, because that's been used as sort of a pejorative to to depict people who are keeping those who are seeking health care away from the services
they
need.
Exactly, and that's incorrect.
And that's not correct. Yeah, what the point of a primary care physician located in the community is to keep people healthy and keep them out of health care that either they don't actually need or that they shouldn't need if they're doing the right things when they're walking, talking, living, breathing, and
healthy. Very well said. Very well said. If you're just joining us, you're listening to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with Dr. Christopher Morley. He's a social science researcher, and we're talking about the current and future shortage of primary care physicians and the potential consequences of this. So getting back to this notion of what can be done about it, medical schools obviously need to play some role in turning this tide. I guess the question is, how can they do that? But even before that, what have they been doing to date?
Well, by and large, some medical school campuses have been opened, and Upstate is one institution that has a regional branch campus down in Binghamton. That's the branch campus tends to have a primary care mission associated with it, and that's not alone. There are whole medical schools that have developed with a primary care mission. But by and large, those tend to be, I think it's fair to say, in the minority of allopathic and medical schools in the U.S. The medical schools that by and large comprise the majority of the community of medical education tend to prioritize based upon what I would say are economic needs, or the needs of its faculty, or the desires, or the impressions of its faculty. Certainly there are things that happen outside of medical school, like the National Health Service Corps, which will fund people to go into primary care, especially in underserved areas. But really, student opinions often form in medical school, and many of them come in stating that they want to go into primary care or go into some kind of underserved care setting. And those two things are linked pretty closely, as it turns out. But what we've done studies here, right, at Upstate that shows that whatever that idealism is, whether it's what they say in an interview or whether it's what they actually believe as they come in, whatever that is, it trails off as they become more worried about debt and lifestyle and the prestige of their career and things like that. That tends to weigh more heavily as they get further through medical school.
So you see a trend that they may be idealistic at the start, but something in the process of their education, whether it be the culture that they find themselves in or the pressures to pay back student loans or what have you, move them a little bit away from that more idealistic vision or mission. So my question then is, what can medical schools be doing?
So we undertook a study to look at the mission statements of medical schools, because it seems like a mission statement should be a pretty simple thing to craft. And frankly, in many industries, you do your mission statement, but then most of us kind of ignore it and we don't pay much attention. Well, it turns out that if you look at the content of the mission statement, that can actually be predictive of the types of physicians you produce. So more on that study in a moment, but what medical schools can do is examine their own culture, the culture that produces that mission statement, or the mission, or the culture that's influenced by that mission statement. Because it turns out students are very impacted by what they hear around them. We've done a study using text messaging, for example, that shows even over a short period of time of about 5 months, student impressions and intentions to go into things like primary care or other service-oriented careers tends to trail off as they hear negative comments from faculty or other students.
Give me an example of some negative comments a medical student might hear. Let's say they come into school very hopeful and idealistic. I'm going to go and work with the underserved. I'm going to work, you know, with the Native American population out in Wyoming or something like that. What factors or what types of messages are they getting to turn them away from this?
Well, they hear things like you'll never pay off your medical school debt. Medical school debt is a huge problem for all sorts of people going into the medical profession, but particularly for those who I'm using air quotes that your listeners can't see, but make a low salary. Typically, that tends to be in the high, you know, the high $100,000 to $200,000 range. But when you're looking at a debt of $200,000-$400,000 at the start of your life, and you're getting at a residency at 28, 29, 30, that's a lot of money to be in debt, and going into just a different specialty can help you pay that off in a very short period of time compared to primary care, where you're going to carry it with you for a while.
But you're suggesting that the culture. So let me get something straight. So you looked at mission statements across medical schools. And so that was your hypothesis, that the mission statement could affect the outcome of how students come out of the medical school with regard to the sense of social responsibility. What did you find?
Well, we examined the mission statements of every medical school in the country, and we had a panel of raters. And these raters were everything from university presidents down to clerkship coordinators and medical students and faculty. And we had them rate each medical school's mission statement on a social mission scale that we developed. Basically, does the mission statement generically speak about producing great physicians or some sort of vanilla statement like that? Or does it actually name populations or types of practices? Do they name a mission to produce primary care physicians? Or do they name, say, taking care of their rural or their underserved or their inner city residents? Particularly, does the medical school set that out as part of its reason for existence?
So once you determined, you rated these medical students, these mission statements, what did you find in terms of outcomes?
Well, it turns out that matters, that the medical schools that have a mission statement that says they are there to do this sort of work, turns out those schools are producing physicians who go on to practice in primary care. They go on to serve in what are called health professional shortage areas or medically underserved areas. Those are federal designations, but they do have some meaning on the ground. They're poor, medically underserved communities.
So what's the conclusion here? I mean, obviously there's something that you're leading up to. What can make a difference then?
We think that medical schools as institutions can be introspective and think about the culture and think about the messages that they give to students. Everything we talked about, for example, with debt or other things that medical students hear, like prestige, there are solutions to those problems. They cannot devalue primary care, and they can point out ways that actually the debt isn't as big a problem once people are practicing. There are all sorts of programs that help relieve debt, and there are ways that those problems can just be simply overcome, and that students who are idealistic can be recruited. They can also select students in accord with the mission. They can select people to come in who have and will maintain an idealistic sense of purpose that underpins the reason they're becoming a physician, as opposed to people who are, you know, chasing prestige or financial security.
And they also can run programs like rural medicine type programs. I know Upstate has one, but those kinds of programs that actually attract and groom individuals who might plan to then go back into these underserved communities.
Absolutely. We have a rural medical program as well, into the RMED program, the Rural Medical Education Program, as well as the MD-MPH program. These programs attract a different type of student. And students who are interested in these underserved areas or population health tend to also go into primary care, and you solve two problems at once.
So the bottom line really is that the medical schools can play a big role in shaping that next crop of doctors, with the notion that perhaps raising the prestige level of primary care and choosing the kind of kids who would perhaps seek that as a career plan, career directive.
Absolutely. The point of our study is that it's not an accident. It's not the simple invisible hand of economics. That medical schools can take an active role in shaping their own culture and supporting programs that lead to the production of students who want to go into primary care and underserved care. These things don't happen as a fait accompli. They have to be an effort.
Thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Christopher Morley, Associate Professor of Family Medicine, Public Health, and Psychiatry at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to HealthLink on Air.